This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Okay, thank you very much. And thank you to the National Museum for collaborating on what is... We've had some really wonderful lectures over the last 12 months. This is the final lecture of the year, but fear not, we will be back again in probably February or March next year, depending on how many speakers we get. So we hope that you will join us for those as well. Okay, so I am very happy to introduce my colleague, Associate Professor Dugald O'Reilly. Dugald works at the School of Archaeology and Anthropology at ANU. He is also the founder and treasurer of a very excellent NGO, Heritage Watch, and has been involved in a whole bunch of really fantastic initiatives involving protection of heritage in this region through everything from apps, the Angkor app that he's got going, which even has the address written on beer mats, I believe, which is excellent. So I hand you over to our last speaker of the CAS year. Thank you very much, Dugald.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you so much for inviting me to the Archaeological Society and the museum as well. So as you can see, tonight I'm going to be talking about the Plain of Jars Archaeological Research Project. So this is a collaborative effort that involves a range of scholars from a lot of different fields, from geographical information systems and human osteology, isotopic analysis, ceramic studies, geology, and of course, archaeology. We also have, as you can see from the first slide here, a number of institutions involved from Laos, our gracious hosts there, Australia, New Zealand, and also involvement of a Polish university. And the research is funded by the Australian Research Council. So in today's lecture, what I'm going to do is introduce the aims of the project, followed by the locations of the sites that we've been investigating in Laos. And I'll briefly outline the history of work and some of the rather peculiar challenges of working in a place like Laos. And then I'll go on to discuss our recent research undertaken in the region, and then turn to our future research, and then talk about the megalithic jars of Laos in a broader context. So we have a lot of aims for our project, and I won't go through them all, but in condensed form, you can see them here. What we hope to do is to document the mortuary practices and try to build a demographic profile of the mortuary population of people who are buried at these megalithic jar sites. We also want to try to understand who created these sites, because this is, at the present moment, unknown. We don't know who made them. We don't know where they lived. And we also want to try to understand the role of these people in the regional exchange networks. And of course, just to clarify what these megalithic sites are all about, what was their real purpose? There's a lot of speculation. So these are the overall aims of our research. So where are we talking about? Well, we're in Laos, in a province called Xiang Kuang, which is a fairly large province, about 16,000 square kilometers. And it's quite high elevation as well. So I have to admit, when I first arrived in Laos, having spent most of my time working in Thailand and Cambodia, I was shocked at the temperatures. In January and February, you really need a down puffer jacket. So a lot of these sites are at high elevation. And it's actually a very wealthy province in many ways. The geology has sandstone and limestone and conglomerate and siltstone, but it's also very rich in copper and ore. And in fact, there's a lot of mining activity taking place in Xiang Kuang right now. And that also probably informs the prehistoric contexts as well. So in 2016, our research was focused at a site called Site 1, which is very close to the provincial capital of Xiang Kuang, which is called Pon Savan. And then in 2017, we returned to work at another site that's named Site 52, which was only discovered in 2005, and it's a large site, as you'll see as we go through the lecture. Now, a recent review of sites accounted for over 120 megalithic jar sites in Laos. So most of these are in Chiang Kuang province, but some are in the neighboring province of Luang Prabang. So on this map, you can see there's different colored dots. The sites that are colored green are sites that were discovered in the 1930s by Madeline Kalani. The red dots are sites that were documented by a UNESCO survey. And then the black dots there are sites that were recently discovered during PhD research. So there's a widespread of sites, and they're, you can see perhaps concentrated around these plateaus there, the whiter areas on that map. Now, the United States, as you probably know, illegally bombed Laos during the secret war in an effort to thwart the flow of men and munitions from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. And the famed Ho Chi Minh Trail passed through what was neutral Laos and, of course, was heavily targeted by U.S. bombing missions. So the data that you can see on the screen here was culled from a database of bombing missions, both high explosive munitions and also very deadly cluster munitions. And if you look at this data, the dates, the payload, the pilots' names are all recorded on these Excel spreadsheets. And as you can see from the slide, about 30% of these cluster munitions remain unexploded. So these are tennis ball-sized objects that litter the ground all over Laos. And are very dangerous, and obviously for children who pick them up and play with them. But they also have an effect or impact on our ability to undertake archaeological research. Now, I'll just take you to Site 1. So this is an aerial movie of Site 1 near Ponsavan, where we undertook our recent research. So in this movie, you can see we're flying over the large group of jars, which is Group 2 on the overlay map there, and you can note the excavations that we're doing. And this flies up to towards Group 3, and you can note also the bomb craters there. So there was a Laotian unit here that was heavily bombed by the U.S. moving up the hill towards Groups 4 and 5. And if you look carefully, you can see a tank scrape from the Laotian or Vietnamese forces that were there. Just the video will come around in a second. I just want you to note that large limestone feature. So that's a cave, which Madeline Kalani believed to be a crematorium. There are three chimney holes in the top of that. And then off in the distance, you can see the most spectacular grouping of jars at this site. That's Group 1. It has the largest and most beautiful jars. And I'll show you an example of those in a minute. So this site has been cleared, by the way, of UXO. So they dug down to a depth of a meter, and about 800 items were discovered and destroyed when the Mine Action Group did their clearance work there. Now, in terms of past research, the jar sites were first described by a British individual named James McCarthy back in 1884. And then, of course, the French became heavily involved in Laos as it became a protectorate, and they sent a mission to northern parts of Laos, central Laos, in 1890. And further exploratory missions, such as this one by Pavi in 1919, were undertaken. But largely, these jars were not seen to be very important or interesting to the colonial powers. But the first archaeological research was done by this woman, Madeline Kalani, and her intrepid sister. So Kalani was actually trained as a geologist in France, and then she was sent out to the colonies, and she was working in Vietnam for the École Française d'Extrême Orient. And her first mission to Laos was in 1931 when she was 65 years old. She's actually a very well-respected archaeologist. She's responsible for naming the Hoabinian culture, which stretches across Southeast Asia. So she discovered that in the Hoabin province in Vietnam. And after the end of her research in Laos, she published a book that you can see on the screen there, which is a massive tome. That's two volumes, published in 1935, that documents not only the jar sites in Laos, but also standing schist menhirs that are found there as well. So the menhirs are to the north of Xianquang in the adjacent province. So this is just an image of these menhirs. So you can see the standing schist stones in the back of the photograph there. Now, Kalani believed that these menhirs actually were older than the jars. So she thought they dated to the Bronze Age, but she didn't have the advantage of radiocarbon dating. So this date still stands, and no further research has been done, nor any dating has been done on these sites. So this is more really juicy, low-hanging fruit for an archaeologist, if you're interested in that. But in this photograph, not only should you note those very large schist standing stones, but please take note of those very substantial discs in the foreground, because they do pop up again later. Now, since the time of Madeline Kalani, there have been a number of smaller projects that have focused on the jar sites in Laos, and most of the work has been done at Site 1. So we have researchers like this Japanese scholar, Eiji Nita, who excavated the site in 1994, and my friend and colleague, Tongsa Sayavong Kamdi, who actually did his PhD at the ANU with Peter Bellwood, worked in the later 1990s. And I should add, these gentlemen are also both intrepid because they dug this site before it was demined or cleared of UXO, so quite dangerous, in fact. More recently, another friend and colleague, Julie Vandenberg, did a major survey and some rescue excavations. So Julie's the one that was in charge of the UNESCO team that discovered most of the known sites today. And most recently, Leah Genovese has produced a PhD thesis on the jars of Laos and done some work on morphology, as you can see from this slide. So she's identified six rim styles that are used across all of the sites in central Laos. Now, probably the first thing people wonder about when they see these megaliths is, what are they for? So this is something that has been obviously speculated about quite widely. And there are a number of possibilities. And these include the interment for human remains. So the dead perhaps were placed inside the jars. Others have suggested that these were used for rotting bodies until all the flesh was decayed, and then the bones would have been removed and buried elsewhere. Others have said, no, these are receptacles for commemorative belongings of the dead, and the dead would be buried beside them, and all of the bounty and the riches would be placed inside the jars. And, of course, local legends are also widely spread. So many of the Lao talk about these being used for brewing rice alcohol or being used by giants as cups for rice alcohol. So a lot of different ideas and explanations about the jars. But there are problems with all of these explanations. So many of the jars are, of course, very big. They're big enough to hold certainly human remains, and indeed, as you can see from these photographs taken by Kalani, large enough to hold many, many people, in fact. But other jars have very small cavities, like this one that you can see here, definitely not large enough to hold a corpse, either for burial purposes or disposal purposes or for defleshing purposes. So it's a little bit of an enigma still. Another interesting thing about these sites is it's not only jars. We also find evidence for discs. So these are most commonly made out of sandstone, and often they are decorated, but also equally often they are plain. So these have been also explained in a number of different ways, and the most perhaps the easiest conclusion to jump to is that they were lids for these jars. But Kalani, when she worked, and being the earliest archaeologist probably has the freshest perspective, noted that she never found a disc sealing one of the jars at these sites. And the other thing that she noted is that there are actually far more jars than there are discs. So some of the jars wouldn't have had lids. And indeed, she thought that the jars probably, if they did have lids, had lids that were made out of organic material, such as wood. We do have sandstone discs found by Kalani that were sealing ceramic jars that were underground, but never found on the megalithic jars. And as I've said here, there's a number of different disc types. So this is, again, illustration from Kalani's magnificent work. So she describes mushroom-shaped discs, pommel discs that you can see there. Sometimes they have a pommel on either side. And also discs with animals carved on them. Kalani described these as macaque carvings on top of the discs. And also, in some cases, humans have been carved onto these lids. Now, I have said that there aren't any lids for the jars, so I should sort of qualify that. At Site 52, it does appear that some of the jars had lids. As you can see, that one that Julie Vandenberg is measuring there has a lip that very easily fits, and when we did our research there, this is quite common. There are jar lids at Site 52, carved for purpose. So let's turn to some of the research we did in 2016. So in February of 2016, we began our work at a site called Ban Hai Hin, or more commonly known as Site 1. So this is the largest jar site and probably the most frequently visited in terms of tourism. So our team, led by myself, Louise Schuen, and Dr. Tonglit Luenkot, began our research there. So what we did was, first of all, to do a survey of the site. So each of the stone jars, the site's got lots of boulders on it as well, had to be geolocated and photographed. So the jars at Site 1 were all measured, and the details on the morphology and the stone type, etc., were recorded. So all of this data will go into a GIS database that, of course, will help with the interpretation of the data. And I see a couple of my PhD students here who will be using this data to complete their theses. And, of course, also it'll be very useful to the Lao, because these sites are hopefully next year, touch wood, going to be inscribed as World Heritage. So this is just a slide showing the kind of information that we gathered on each disc, as well as, of course, the geolocation of these things. We also did quite a bit of photogrammetry. So the data captured in drone videos and also 3D imaging of each of the pits that we excavated were put into a computing unit at Monash called the Cave 2 Simulator. So this is an amazing facility. It's a big room, almost 360 degrees of these high-definition monitors, and you can see you can put on 3D glasses with a little device that actually allows you to walk through the 3D environment. But it also is sort of useful because you can virtually re-excavate the site this way, so every spit was recorded in three dimensions, and you can go backward or forward as you like. So this was a pilot grant that was awarded to my colleague Louise Schuen for processing this data in the Cave 2. And also, of course, you can use this photogrammetry to record the jars as well. And this is really useful for post-field analysis and also, of course, for future monitoring of the heritage assets in Laos. So the Lao authorities can use this technology to see if there's damage or changes to the jars. And using this software, you can do things like calculate the volume or the weight of individual jars, etc. So this is just a low-resolution example of one of these jars, which is about probably a little over 2 meters in height and well over 20 tons in weight. And one other thing on this photograph that you should note is that big boulder beside the jar. So this is one of these quartz-rich boulders that litter the area of Site 1. So let's turn to the actual digging, the excavations. We, as I said, started in February 2016, and this is just an overhead shot of Site 1 with Unit 1 partially backfilled and another of the smaller units, Unit 3, over there. But we selected Unit 1 because it had a sort of conglomeration of different features. So we found that there was a large number of large stone jars, actually. There's also a sandstone disc and, of course, one of these quartz-rich boulders, which, according to previous research, of course, were potential burial markers. So we excavated a 3-by-3-meter unit with a little bit of extensions on the sides to investigate these features. So about 20 centimeters down, we discovered a layer of sandstone chips. So these will be analyzed in the near future to see if they are actually related to the jar or they're unrelated or, and were brought in from elsewhere. It's possible that these represent some kind of finishing of the jars in situ. So these, I'll tell you about where the jars come from, but they don't originate at Site 1. So, but they may have been brought as sort of rough outs and then finished on site. So that pavement from the previous slide can be seen intruding into the main unit here. You can see the text in white. And also we moved that large sandstone disc that you can see in the rear of the unit there and excavated underneath it. So once we were able to lift it, which was no small task, we found some very interesting finds. So indeed, right underneath that disc was this mortuary context. Overall, we found 3 mortuary contexts in Unit 1, and one burial was underneath this sandstone disc. So there's no evidence for occupation material at this site at all, and there is, in fact, quite a lot of overburden at the site, so it's been abandoned for quite some time. But here in this photograph, you can see there's this incredibly bright white limestone, and then associated with that, these human bones, which it's not a complete skeleton, but it's a bundle of pieces of long bone from a human being. So beneath the pavement of sandstone chips that I mentioned was another burial. And again, you can see these limestone boulders sticking out of the block or wall of the excavation unit there. So as Kalani noted in her excavations, nothing was found underneath the megalithic jars in terms of human remains. But if you do look in the far right-hand side of that slide, you can see there's a boulder there. And that's right at ground level in the prehistoric period, or at least the period when the jar was placed. So I'm guessing that that might have been put in as a sort of shiv to balance this bar. And also in this unit, as you can see from the text on the slide, we had one burial that was associated with one of these quartz-rich boulders. You can't see it in the photograph there. And another that had no visible markers aside from these buried limestone slabs that were underground. So that was Unit 1. The second unit that we excavated was actually selected based on findings from a ground-penetrating radar unit, and the operator informed us that there was a very large anomaly under the ground, about a meter or so. So we decided that we would sink a unit there, sort of in an open area. And again, when we excavated, we found this interesting pavement of sandstone chips. So this rough pavement of stones can be seen here in the bottom right of this image, and of course this mirrors what we found in Unit 1 and was also reported around the jars when Sayavong Kamdi excavated in the late 90s. And they appear to be related to interments that are found underneath them. So, the anomaly detected by the GPR was not as large as expected, but it was indeed this interesting perforated slab of limestone. And what was underneath the limestone, you can see peeking out, is a human cranium. So it appears as though the skull was positioned underneath this limestone so that the individual is actually peering out through the perforation in that slab. So this is a primary burial, and this has not actually been found previously at the Plain of Jars. So that was very exciting and interesting. And when we continued to excavate, we found the remains of an adult, as you can see, in a flexed position, as well as the skull of an 8-year-old child that were found on top of the postcranial remains of this individual. Now, the bone preservation was rather poor, unfortunately, and there was not a lot of grave goods in the burial either. We did find a little miniature ceramic vessel, very similar in shape to the large megalithic jars, which is interesting. And these were actually reported by other excavators. Kalani and Sayavong Kamdi found similar jars. And I'll show you an example of what I'm talking about in a minute. So that was Unit 2. Unit 3 was selected because we found one of these pommel discs that Kalani noted. And we decided we should investigate what was going on in this region. And you'll note, actually, again, at the top of the photograph is one of these quartz-rich boulders that I've been mentioning. So beneath this disc were found some human teeth and several limestone blocks. So again, all this sort of repeated pattern of indicators of mortuary activity. There was a little bit of disturbance in this unit, but after the about 10 centimeters, it was undisturbed. So on top, there were some war remains from the 1970s, a bit of shrapnel and some clothing. But otherwise, the unit was undisturbed. So the limestone blocks that we found were, again, placed on top of further burials. And in this unit, we have evidence for secondary burial and also burial inside ceramic jars. So we have this whole suite of different mortuary activities going on. And the remains of infants were actually found in two of the jars. So in this photograph, maybe it's a little hard to find, but you can see some linear features. They're tiny little rib bones of a neonate. One of the jars didn't have any evidence for human remains, but it's possible if it was a very young individual, these have disintegrated. So once we had finished excavating or got to the bottom or the sterile layer, at least, this is what it looked like. So the jars in the photo were apparently unmarked by any boulders, but these are very similar to the jars that were found by Vandenberg when she did her rescue excavations, and also jars like this were noted by Kalani and Sayavong Kamdi. And again, you can see the limestone is in there that is related to the burial. So we extracted these ceramic vessels that you can see here, and they were removed to a laboratory for further analysis. But when we removed them, we were astounded to find a fourth jar that was in the bog. And you can see that it sits directly underneath that very large quartz-rich boulder. So the inset photo shows you the boulder. You can get an idea of the size of it. So considerable amount of effort went into interring this individual. Now, we left that in situ. We had run out of time and were unable to extract it, so it remains there. But it does prove that these boulders were used for the demarcation of internments at Site 1. So the jars that we've just been talking about, a lot of them have this really interesting lacquer applied to them, some sort of organic coating that you can see in the photograph here. So we're hoping to have this analyzed. I have to be honest, our first attempts have failed in identifying. I had thought that it was a resin, but experts at the British Museum have said that it doesn't have any qualities of resin, and they're still working because they're intrigued now as to what it might be. But it certainly doesn't look like a glaze or anything, and it appears to be some kind of organic material, or some sort of vegetable lacquer. But the mortuary context, just to run quite quickly through them. In Unit 1, we had an adult. We don't know the sex of that. There was the remains of a female and also an infant remain, and then another unknown, another adult of unknown sex and a fetus. In the second unit, we found that there was, this is one with primary burial remains, and this is an adult female, and as I said before, the remains of an 8-year-old child. And then Unit 3, with the ceramic jar burials, we find a flex of bone and teeth found atop the jars. So we're not sure what those are, but certainly human remains. Another of the jars had an adult male And also that you can see in the photograph there, the long bones. So this is not in a jar burial. And then inside one of the jars, as I mentioned, a neonate or a very young individual found there. Again, some photographs of that, those remains. And also the remains in another jar of a 4 to 6 year old child. So an interesting range of mortuary context in all three units. And I mentioned that Julie had found similar ceramic jars when she did the rescue excavation. And one of the ceramic, we actually excavated the jars that she found because they had just remained in the museum since the mid-2000s. But we did find fragments of bones, but very little other evidence. But glass beads were found, so some sort of burial offerings were found in those. And also a range of other material culture. I should say it was not overwhelming, so it was nice for neat record keeping. But we do find some interesting artifacts, and I'll show you some of those now. They include what appears to be a pendant that was found actually right at the base of one of the big jars, the one I showed you being excavated, probably made out of chlorite. And identical pendant was found by Kalani in the 1930s. And you might remember I mentioned those little tiny ceramic jars. This is what they look like. So they're almost identical to these giant megalithic jars, but in ceramics. They're only about that big. So we're hoping to do some residue analysis to see if there's any way to tell what was contained in those. This is another one of those found in our excavations. We also found agate. So this is agate's very common in certainly Iron Age, Southeast Asia, found in burials very commonly. We only found one agate bead, and it's not of the greatest quality. It's not that beautiful. Carnelian, we found one carnelian bead, and you can probably see from the photograph here, that also is not of the highest quality. It's a pretty rough-looking piece of jewelry. We found evidence for cloth making in the form of spindle whorls. There was a few spindle whorls found. And also a presumed ear lug. This kind of looks like a pulley as it's got a groove around the outside of the disc, so probably used place in the ear with the groove holding it in place. So, in total, at site one, we found the remains of 18 individuals. So that equates to about 1.2 individuals per square meter. And if you extrapolate those numbers to the entire site, which is almost 7,000 square meters, it equates to somewhat around 8,000 individuals potentially buried at this site, which is obviously quite breathtaking. And if the dates that we have are consistent, this means that it was done within a fairly limited chronological time span of probably about 200 or 300 years. And also of interest, of course, is the range of mortuary practices that we've uncovered. So we've seen already primary inhumation. We've got the ceramic jar burials and these secondary bundle burials being found as well. So we're getting a good idea of a sort of very robust cultural trend at site one. And the other question everybody wants to know about, of course, is the dating. Duncan, is there any more water? Sorry. So our dates were run by the ANU radiocarbon lab, and luckily for us, they came out quite nicely clustered chronologically. So what we have is evidence for mortuary activity dating between, surprisingly to many probably who know about the jars, but dating from the 9th century to the 13th century AD. So this is the same sort of time span as Angkor Wat, which is, I think, very, very interesting and telling. So one sample that was taken from beneath a megalithic jar, thank you for that, returned a date of 1163 to 1256 AD, which provides a very interesting terminus post quem for the jar above this context. So the late date of this site actually was hinted at by Saya Vong Kam Di, because he also ran some radiocarbon dates from his excavations. But other dates of his placed the site in the Iron Age, and Kalani also thought these were Iron Age deposits across Laos. So these new dates strongly suggest a much more recent use of the jar sites than previously thought. So while we were digging at Site 1, we also took some time to investigate quarry sites. So the excavation and the mapping were not the only things we were interested in doing, but we wanted to look at the relationship of these jar sites to these sites that have been identified as quarry sites. So the quarry site that is related to Site 1 is about 8 kilometers away, while the quarry for Sites 2 and 3, which are also nearby Site 1, are about 5 kilometers away from those sites. So these are massive jars weighing several tons going over undulating terrain. How did they move them? This is an interesting question. So one of the things I'm really interested in trying to do is perhaps deploy some LIDAR that could potentially render evidence for tracks for these, drag marks, whatever, to try to investigate how they were transporting these massively heavy jars into their final resting places. But a LIDAR would also be useful perhaps in identifying occupation sites. So our efforts so far have been fruitless to find out where these people lived. So we have no occupation evidence at all. But if we have do deploy LIDAR, it may be possible to identify agricultural activity in the prehistoric or sort of middle historic period. So we'll see. Now, this is some imagery from the quarry site that's near Site 2, and you can very clearly see the chisel marks there. But why some of the, and this is a jar in the foreground here, but why some of these jars have been left behind is a bit of a mystery. Now, Sayavong Kamdi believes that there was a catastrophic event that led to the collapse of the society, and the jars were just abandoned and people disappeared or ran away, which is not impossible, of course. So it would be really useful to mount an investigation of the jars that are left in these quarries. It's also possible, of course, that there were faults in the jars and the stonemasons just stopped working on them and moved on to better quality stone. Problem with the quarry sites is none of them have been cleared of UXO, so it is quite dangerous to access these. We also found evidence for a possible quarry for those quartz-rich boulders. So you can see this hillside there littered with these boulders. So we were able to sample these, and hopefully we'll be do a cross-comparison between the ones at Site 1 and these ones in this possible quarry. So I will now turn to our work in 2017. So in 2017, we went to another jar site that is equally large, and I mentioned it's only discovered in 2005. It's more of a typical jar site because it's at a higher elevation. The sites 1, 2, and 3 are actually on a plain at a fairly low elevation. Most of the jar sites are in more elevated areas on mountain spurs, etc. So this site is about 200 meters above jar site 1. And I think it's about, as I said, 30 kilometers distant. But the site comprises a huge number of jars, 415 stone jars, 219 of these discs and lids, and hundreds of boulders. So these jars are all placed in very discrete groups. So originally there were 4 jars. This is a map that has been created from our recent work. So 4 jar groups were known at Site 52. And then 2 further groups of jars were located in 2017 by our research. So there's still a lot of jars out there, and it's very difficult to find them. Again, LIDAR would be really useful in this context because you have to slog through the jungle to find these things. And we also excavated at Site 52. So we have 8 units selected for excavation in groups 1, 2, and 3, denoted by the red circles there. Now, aside from those 2 new jar groups that we found at 52, Several previously unknown quarries or perhaps transport sites were also identified. And most of these were found at a lower elevation than Site 52. So it seems like they were quarrying the stone and then bringing these big jars up to the site. And we assigned those as Q sites. You can just zoom in on that. So the circle on that map is Site 52 with the various groups identified. And then the Q sites are the new sites, and the other sites there are ones identified, also quarry sites, I should add, by Vandenberg. And when I say we discovered them, I should give all credit to the gentleman who lived in the village, who was like, oh yeah, you want jar sites? So off he took us. What a star. So the excavations at Site 52 were actually not as profitable as those at Site 51. What we did find, of course, were similar megalithic jars and configurations identified. So we found when we excavated evidence for these chips of sandstone in pavement form, we also found limestone slabs related to mortuary activity, and also discs were found as well. So our big find was one tooth evidencing mortuary activity. But it was found, very importantly, beside this limestone slab that you can see there, along with the ceramic vessel, again with that interesting organic coating, and a glass bead. So a little bit disappointing in terms of finds, but I think still we have good evidence that these sites had a similar purpose in terms of mortuary disposal. Now, what's also interesting about the jars is that they're not only found in Laos. In Sulawesi, there are 15 sites that have about 93 jars distributed between them, called kalambas. Now, not a lot of work has been done on the jar sites in Sulawesi, but they have done some analysis of material culture, and they've done some pollen dating on these sites, which is really interesting because they fall in the same time period as the jars in Laos, no earlier than the 9th century AD. There are, however, some stylistic similarities, as you can probably see from the photographs there, of these jars in Sulawesi and the jars in Laos. So we find they have these knobbed lids and also interesting zoomorphic designs on them. Now, there's a PhD being produced on these jars from Sulawesi, so I'm really awaiting with bated breath to get hold of that. And it should be a very interesting resource for comparison to the data that we've collected. There's also some interesting linguistic links regarding the jars and the cultures that were producing jars. So some of the earlier language groups that were known in Xianguang province belong to the Austroasiatic family. And it is possible, we can't confirm this, but I think I might have forgotten to add that we hope to get some DNA from that burial in Unit 2. It's past the first hurdle. So again, we're sort of on tenterhooks waiting for that. But it is possible that these jars were made by people who were Khmu, and they are known actually to have inhabited Xianguang. Now, that's all very well and good, but there's something even more interesting, because in the North Kachar Hills of Assam in northeast India, there's a group of people who also are members of the Austroasiatic family who are speakers of Khasi. And then if you look at this map, that's interesting. So this map illustrates the current distribution of Austroasiatic languages. Obviously, it's fragmented considerably since prehistoric times. But there you can see the Khasi over on the left at the top in India, and the purple are the distribution of Khmuic speakers. I should hasten to add that there aren't any specific subgrouping links between the Khasi and Khmu, but there is a shared ancestry between these groups. And our colleague Paul Sidwell at the ANU believes this ancestry probably dates back around 4,000 years, or perhaps even less than that. So we have this sort of interesting linguistic link between North India and Laos. And if we look at the genetic evidence, it's also interesting. So there's a couple of hypotheses regarding the origin and the timing of dispersal of people who spoke Austroasiatic languages. One of the ideas is that they originate in Southeast Asia and had a dispersal during the Neolithic period into India or South Asia. And the opposing idea is that they had pre-Neolithic origins and moved into Southeast Asia from India. So these are two different ideas. But a recent paper argues that, indeed, the genetic evidence does support the move of people from Southeast Asia into India, probably about 20,000 years ago, or perhaps more recently. But definitely, according to Chaube, this movement was going towards India. The pathways exact and the exact timings, of course, are unresolved, and more research is needed. Now, okay, why am I talking about this? Well, that's a good question. Because in the 1920s, two British researchers called Mills and Hutton reported the presence of megalithic jars in Assam in northeast India. So this makes these linguistic connections really intriguing. The question about these jars, whether these jars, which of course bear very strong resemblances to those in Laos, is a very valid one. And so this is going to be one of the focuses of our ongoing research. So we've been very close contact with the Indian our Indian colleagues who are working on these. Dr. Tilak Thakuria is leading research on these. And we invited him to actually excavate with us at Site 52 last year. And his opinion, there's a very close similarity, 90%, to quote him, in similarity between these jars. So there are lots of jars and megalithic sites, not lots of jars, but lots of megalithic sites in India, from Tamil Nadu to Andhra Pradesh, etc. You can see them circled on the map. But most of these megalithic sites are of considerable antiquity. They mostly date back to around 1500 BC. And in some cases, they're quite a bit different. You can see from these images, they're chambered megaliths and cysts, and dolmens, but then look at that picture down in the bottom right from Assam. Wow, it's almost identical to those similar standing stones in Laos, right down to the discs. It's pretty amazing. So the researchers in Assam, Tilak and his colleagues, have identified six megalithic jar sites in the Dimahasao Hills, of North Kachar, and again, they've identified a whole range very similar to the work done by Genovese. So there are undeniable parallels morphologically between these jars and the jars of Laos, I think you'll agree, and as I said, we're currently working to establish a research project with our Indian colleagues, so there's much work to be done there. And so I'll thank you very much for your kind attention, and I think I've got a little drone video to leave you with there. So thank you again. Oh, you don't have to. You can ask questions if you want. You don't have to sit there. Jaws agog. Oh, yeah, parched, so. Thanks.
I think everyone is loving the video. All right. Just check that this is on. All good? Okay. All right, got a first question up here.
Thank you very much for a fascinating presentation. You mentioned, and it was shown in that video just at the end there, the cave sites in the outcrop, but you didn't come back to them. Have they been investigated at all there?
Yes. Yeah, so you can see there's an entrance to that, and there's whole chimney holes in the top of that. So it was very thoroughly excavated by Madeline Kalani, right wall to wall. So there's nothing more to see in there, unfortunately. I know my colleague Saivon Kamdi excavated in there as well, but he didn't report finding anything. And there's quite a bit of disturbance since the war. I understand that it had a direct rocket hit, went straight in the cave mouth. It was used for storing munitions by the Pathet Lao. So, yeah, it's pretty badly damaged.
Another question?
Yes, thank you for a fascinating presentation. I just wondered if there'd been any scraping or analysis of the inside of the jars.
Excellent question. Yes, we actually took cores last field season from Site 52. Indeed, I was interested to see if there's any lipids from decomposition, perhaps. So that's been sent off to the UK for lipid analysis, residue analysis. So, again, we'll find out shortly. There's a lot of stuff in the pipe that...
You're going to come back and tell us.
That's right, yeah. Sorry.
Anyone else?
Was there any evidence of looting?
Not when we excavated. So the only evidence of disturbance that we found was from the UXO clearance. But I guess one of the great benefits of these sites is the paucity of material. It's not worth looting them because there's nothing there. I mean, really. No, yeah, it's there is no evidence of looters' pits or anything. I mean, I'm really familiar with looting, so I know what to look for, having worked in Cambodia where it's rampant. But here there isn't very... I mean, jars are taken, yes, so in that regard, but in terms of subsurface looting, no. Yeah.
Yep, coming over.
I don't know if this is of help, but in the early 80s, I went to Turfan or Turpan on the way to Kashgar and saw a vessel like that that had blood on the outside that was new.
A new one?
Yeah.
Wow.
That had that colour. And I just wonder if that was the same thing or just happened to look the same, and that that outside thing was not baked blood.
Oh, possibly, yeah. This the outside thing of
on those jars.
Oh, I see. Oh, so you're talking about it's a ceramic jar vessel that you saw, and it had blood on it, and you think, oh, okay, yeah, well, baked blood, yeah. It's, so yeah, I should look into it. No, that's helpful. Thank you. Yeah.
Got time for another question or two?
When you looked at the quarry sites, was there any further evidence there about whether the jars were finished in situ or in the rough?
Yeah, it, when you go to the quarry sites, it appears that the jars were completed there. They're all in various states of completion. Some have little hollows, some are completed all the way, but then have a crack. So perhaps that final hammer blow... You know, so it looks like they were finishing the jars at the quarry and then moving them. But possibly they did some final retouching on site, which might explain those chips. So I'm really eager to find out about those pavements. But they also seem very closely related to mortuary activity. So it might be that they're unrelated to the jars.
Do you have any idea on how they were moved from the quarry site to where they are now? Because this is a mammoth job over all these sites going up and down the hill. So, to me, it's quite fascinating that there must have been so much effort put into doing this for such a long period of time.
Well, I mean, I can only speculate. We have to get Mythbusters over to help us out with that. But, I mean, I think, you know, elephants are not an impossibility. Madeline Kalani did a lot of calculations in her two-volume book about this and looked at places in Indonesia, et cetera, where they move large megaliths by human power. So she has drawings of these bamboo things and calculated how many individuals it would take to lift it and how far they could carry it and that sort of thing. But, I mean, yeah, it's pure speculation how they moved them. Whether they were dragged or rolled on logs, et cetera. But it would be fun to do some experimental archaeology. Yeah. We should also test to see if they're good for rice alcohol brewing, I think.
Are you aware of the megaliths at, on the island of Sumba?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, apparently they get moved by humans.
Yep, that's, yeah.
On banana trunks, banana tree trunks.
Yeah, so rolled along, yeah. So, I mean, that's probable that they were using some sort of traction like that. But, again, elephants may have been involved. I mean, if the dates are right, I mean, yeah, yeah.
So, do you know that they were growing rice?
We don't have any data from that yet, but we do hope in the coming season to try to collect some environmental evidence. So a colleague of mine in the UK is interested to analyze that. But again, these aren't domestic sites, so there's no evidence of any domestic activity. So I'm not hopeful necessarily that we'll find a lot of evidence for that, but it's possible. Yeah, I'm not a subscriber to that theory, but I really do think that these have a mortuary function. I mean, you can make rice wine in a big clay thing. You don't need to carve out a 20-ton stone jar to do it, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly of interest. But
is there anything distinctive about the sites where the jars have ended up? Given that they're found at a number of locations, are they all especially high or in any indication
at all?
Well,
I mean, I should turn your attention to the gentleman sitting directly in front of you. So he's going to be looking at that for his PhD thesis. So basically analyzing the placement of these stone jars in the wider environment to try to analyze view sheds, that kind of thing, why they chose these sites. But without doing any calculations or in-depth analysis, it does appear that a lot or a majority of them are located on mountain ridges or, you know, spurs, what have you, with a very, you know, good view of the surrounding countryside. Most of them are elevated. So these ones, 1, 2, and 3, are kind of anomalies, really. But that makes them accessible to tourists, which is good, I guess.
Okay, unless anyone has one last burning question. If it's a brief statement.
You mentioned tourists, and I was there last year, 12 months ago, as a tourist. There are tourists that go there. It's a fascinating place.
Yes, it certainly is. Do you enjoy it? Yeah. Yeah, I recommend everybody go. And the food is great, and the people are wonderful. So. No, I haven't. I can't dismiss any theory. without evidence, certainly I have not dismissed theories. But again, I mean, storage for, you know, what purpose, and why are they only there and not really found? Yeah. Well, I mean, that's possible. But no, I haven't dismissed that.
All right. I think that's it. Perfect time to wrap it up, and I'm sure everyone would like to give a big thanks to Dougal for tonight's lecture.
Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.